Hello, I'm Michael Heyman, and you're listening to Changemakers, the podcast from Seven Hills, where we hear from inspirational people with a passion to make a difference. Now, be yourself. That's the worst advice you could give to an impressionist. Well, they're not my words, but they are those of my guest today, Rory Bremner. Who else? Rory, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. The worst, absolutely. That's a true story. It was a Royal Variety show. I was terrified walking around the wings, and somebody just came up and said, don't worry. Just go out there and be yourself. And I did think, you do know I'm an impressionist, don't you? And I went out and I forgot all my words. So I've still got PTSD from that one. But there you go.
But who are you enjoying impersonating the most these days? I mean, so much material to go on, I'd imagine.
Yeah, I mean, although funnily enough, I remember John Fortune, when somebody said, you must have so much material, John would sort of hand them a pen and they'd say, would you like to write it? Because, I do feel we're living this box set life at the moment where, the writers are kind of excelling themselves every day. I mean, if I have a sort of idea of a Boris, the clown, the Boris box set, the clown. Series one ended with him and Michael Gove the morning after Brexit, standing there looking like the producers in that wonderful Mel Brooks film, realizing that Springtime for Hitler is going to be a great hit. That was series one. Series two ends with Boris going into intensive care, for heaven's sake, dramatically. And then the opener of series three is Carrie giving birth to his son. In hospital. So it is remarkable twists and turns. And so it's keeping up, isn't it? It's keeping up with what's going on. And Trump, people talk about, is laughter the best medicine? But, I think bleach, Michael, try it. Disinfectant. You know what they call, what do they call it? Is it Dettol or dumb as dust? So, try it. Shine a torch up your ass.
I mean, I'm glad you let rip there with the Donald. I mean, Boris, I'm sure you're going to come back to, but do you find, obviously we're living in, pretty tough times right now in terms of COVID and all the rest of it. I mean, how easy is it being a comedian when all around you, it does feel so dark and difficult? Or is that what we need?
Well, it is in a way. I mean, it's just how we are. It's how we perceive it, how humans are as well. I mean, I suppose British, one of the few examples of British exceptionalism, which I cling to because the rest of British exceptionalism, Boris loved to say we're world beating. But at the moment, seems to be world beating in terms of, deaths and depths of recession. But I think people do. They like to look at stuff that's flying around on Twitter and on YouTube and on WhatsApp. People do like to be cheered up. We do have this thing. I mean, I'm not saying that, you should put on a clown outfit and wander around the Nightingale Hospital or intensive care, anytime soon. But what I am saying is that, there's a human need to come together. Songs and choirs and music is one way we're doing it, and humor is another way we're doing it. My sort of extra thing is the satirical thing, but I think Trump and Boris have got that pretty well squared off at the moment. They seem to, people say, you couldn't make it up, but Trump and to an extent Boris, they just make it up every day, and you just don't know what's coming next. You're going to wait for Trump to come out on Black Lives Matter and say, I was a great friend of Martin Luther King. I knew him very well. We were really close, played a lot of golf, and I shot him. That's how close we were. And I knew his sister, Billie Jean, knew her very well. And he's like, on one level, Ian Hislop, I think, has said, it's kind of easy because they are gifts and grotesques, and satire sort of thrives on that. But on the other hand, there is a seriousness about this. And I kind of, the serious side is to say that the skill set that got Trump into the White House and that got Boris into Downing Street and got Brexit done, that skill set is not what you need in a pandemic, because, the skill set for Brexit and Boris is all bluster and bombast and, this is nationalism and come on, we can do this. Whereas, COVID requires a kind of an Angela Merkel or even a David Miliband when you hear about his experiences with I think it always sounds like something out of Thunderbirds, doesn't it? The International Rescue Committee. But, there's a guy talking about Ebola or Africa or the work they're doing out there, or even Gordon Brown. You know, there's a sense of the international response, and as he did in sort of 2008, where, you know, like him or not, he was always say about Gordon Brown that, you know, he was good in a crisis, but sometimes he had to create one first. But nevertheless, you know, he rose to that and galvanized Obama, and they did between them, you know, come up with an international response.
Because you've covered all, I mean, you've mentioned just some of those names, Gordon Brown, David Miliband, Boris, all David Cameron. You mean you've seen them over the years. I mean, my sense is also is that satire, humor has also been an important way of keeping them to account. I mean, do you see that actually you've got a role actually by pointing out who they are, what they are, how you see them, that you're holding a mirror up to the powerful?
Well, I feel we went missing during the coalition because the series stopped in 2010. And it's easy to look back at the coalition in some way as something that's in sort of slightly kind of benign, where the Lib Dems were sort of by and large acting as a conscience to the Conservatives and all the rest of it. But it wasn't that, actually. There's a lot going on, you know, particularly with benefit sanctions and, you know, I mean, what Ian Duncan Smith was doing. I mean, you know, I'm sorry to say. And the seeds of Brexit were being sown during the coalition and during austerity. And I kind of miss, I'm sad that we weren't around to track the rise of Farage and the rise of Brexit. We were kind of missing when all that was going on, because we weren't doing a series. I mean, people say to me even now, they say, oh, what would John Byrne and John Fortune make of all this? And, you know, I think of, you know, what they would have made during, you know, the rise of UKIP and the run-up to Brexit and even, you know, the Scottish referendum, all these things that happened, because the landscape has changed. When you and I, were, if you're looking back about 10 or 15 years ago, or even back to 2008 or so, there was that change because from about 2000 onwards, it was all about the economy. You know, Bill Clinton is the economy, stupid. And everything became about the economy to the extent that all these economists and business people like Robert Peston and Evan Davis and Faisal Islam shifted from being economics and business correspondents to being political correspondents, because economics was politics. And then in 2014 and the referendum in 2016, Brexit, politics came back. Because in this world of just economics, people felt left behind. They felt alienated by globalization. It wasn't working for them. And politics came back and bit hard. And so that's what, you know, that's the sort of landscape. And I think it's been intensely political since.
And does that give you more personality to go at as an impressionist, as a satirist?
No, it gives you, I think there is a narrative going on there, which I think we could have latched onto and should have kind of tracked in comedy terms, because, you know, we had a license, or in the past, sort of, you know, comedians had a license, you know, the licensed fool that you could send up politicians. But again, that's changed as well, because, you know, the comedians are being judged politically and programs are being taken off air. And, you know, you look on Twitter now, if I've done some sketch about Nicola Sturgeon or mentioned something there, you know, I would get the pile in from the SNP. Or if I do something about Boris, I'll get the pile in from the Brexiteers.
Are you bothered about that though? Does that ever, do you ever feel?
It bothers me culturally, because it's an attempt of from the other side to shut you down. And I think that it's important that I think that the world is too, you know, you can't just leave it to the politicians. And comedians, I think, I like the idea that people know where we're coming from, and we're coming from a human perspective, that we're not. I'm, you know, fair-minded enough, I hope, to be able to see the strengths of both sides. I mean, I've said both Labour and Conservative governments over the years, and I try to kind of take my pulse as to whether I'm being fair-minded or not. But that's being fair-minded is different from being unbiased, because you've gone so far down this track of bias and non-bias that the next time Ellen MacArthur comes back from a round-the-world voyage, they're going to have to put on somebody from the Flat Earth Society to argue the other side of the argument.
But what I love about your story is that, I mean, people that have seen you on the stage or seen you on TV, they know of you as a performer. But also, I mean, you're a brilliant mischief maker as well. I mean, you know, I mean, it was reported in January that the former cabinet secretary, Sir Robin Butler, was so concerned about your impression of John Major that he said you might have even brought the government down because you were pranking Conservative MPs with a, what was it, an 11-seat majority, I think he had, or whatever he had in those days.
If you remember, Michael, that it was distinctly uncomfortable, if I may say so. Yeah, those are the major days. And we rang up some Eurosceptics. I mean, I don't know if you can imagine a world where a Conservative Prime Minister is given a hard time from Eurosceptic backbenchers. I mean, I don't know if it rings any bells. I mean, it was never going to go anywhere, that Eurosceptic movement. I mean, you know, they were... Clearly, what was it to David Cameron? I mean, they were fruitcakes. I mean, I don't think they're going to go anywhere. And that was, it is, look back and you think of it as being an innocent time. And things, is that Lenin thing about, you know, there are decades when nothing happens for weeks, and then there are weeks when decades happen. So you look back to that time with Major. But yeah, it was, we were messing around. It was the early days of the Rory Bremner Who Else programme at Channel 4. I'd rung up Richard Boddy, and I think, what was his name? Carlyle, not Robert Carlyle, but anyway, there was another kind of junior minister, but the tape didn't work. We weren't recording. But anyway, we started to ring back benches because we knew that Major was out of the country. But this got back to Robin Butler, and a few people said, I've spoken to John Major, I've spoken to the Prime Minister, and they said, well, no, you haven't. And I think Richard Boddy actually said, well, look, I think I'd know if it was some. So they realised that something was going on, and Robin Butler, slightly old boy network, rang up Michael Grade and said, I think we've got a problem here. And anyway, they sort of got to the bottom of it. And they were just worried that I was going to ring up Ken Clark. Why is that more likely that I was going to ring up somebody as Kenneth Clark? I remember he was one of my favourite characters, and I just loved doing him. Michael Grade sort of called us, and I think we had to hand over the tape, and it just ended up as an anecdote in John Major's book. I think he talks about that young wag.
I mean, but it does seem like the 90s, I mean, it seems like such an innocent time compared to, you know, the sort of the high stakes politics that we're living in 2020. I mean,
well, something's gone wrong right around the world. If you look at other countries as well. I mean, you look at Orban in Hungary, Duterte in the Philippines, Erdogan in Turkey, Bolsonaro in Brazil. What's happening is this takeover by these strongmen demagogues, and they're kind of undermining and undermining these institutions like the World Health Organization and NATO and the United Nations and European Union that were set up after the war to undo the damage done by the last generation. So there's something big that's happening here. Yeah. But, you know, then you throw in something like COVID-19, like a pandemic, and... You know, nationalism does not protect you from diseases, whereas internationalism arguably could.
Could. I mean, but also there are causes that are dear to your heart, you know, ADHD, attention deficit, hyperactivity disorder, to name one, where you've got to create a voice, create awareness in an environment where so many people are being squeezed out because actually we're becoming so much more single issue about whether it's the virus or I guess these big challenging issues that you're talking about. How do you make sure that some of the things you care about get the attention they deserve?
Well, I think mental health generally is very much become a thing. I think Labour under Gordon Brown again, they seem to sort of push a lot with things like dyslexia and dyspraxia, and the Liberals were quite good about this as well. Norman Lamb, particularly, I think they pushed the mental health agenda. So, you know, it's now okay. BBC have done a lot of programs, and a lot of people from Vinnie Jones to Freddie Flintoff have spoken out about it. In my case, it was ADHD. I recognized it in another relative. But what's interesting, because, you know, there are people are different, you know, and with ADHD, people have a tremendous energy and irrepressibility and an impetuosity, but also an obsessiveness about if you find an ADHD person, it's not attention deficit, it's attention surfeit. They're paying attention to too many different things. And if they find something which is a really passionate interest, they can be absolutely lost in that. And the interesting thing about that is that employers are now, this is the sort of one of the benefits of the concentration on mental health, is that employers are increasingly encouraged to recruit people who are neurodiverse. And neurodiversity is, one example, I suppose, when Dominic Cummings was talking about, you know, wanting weirdos and stuff to work in the civil service. But, you know, I think in GCHQ and in other areas, there are things that people who are neurodiverse, people who are different, who maybe are, you know, look at, Alan Turing, for example. I mean, I don't know. I think he must have been on the spectrum, you know, autistically, but brilliant and a genius brain. And so I think, you know, there's a positive side to this mental health argument.
Well, I agree with you that the issue is up there. But when you look at the charities that are supporting, you are very closely connected with charities supporting this issue. In terms of actually how that turns into, I guess, their sort of opportunity to sort of like, you know, get out there and campaign, do the things. I was looking at a tweet that you said about that, you know, actually this is a tough time for those sorts of charities right now.
It is because coronavirus and the National Health Service and carers, for very good reason, has sucked all of the fundraising attention into this, the only game in town, and it's hard to argue again. You can see we've not seen something on this scale. I mean, you know, in Britain alone, anything from 40 to 60,000 deaths. I mean, it's just, if you said to somebody, do you realize in the first 6 months of your government, Boris, or whatever it is, that, you know, you're going to be hit by a pandemic and there'll be tens of thousands of people will die. So naturally, but that's meant such, I mean, in my particular thing with hospitality, because of course, a lot of fundraising is bringing people together for fundraising dinners, fundraising things, or auctions. Again, it's about, so we can't do that anymore. And people's attention has been diverted. So one of the things that I can do, as well as just put out the kind of tweets and host quizzes and stuff like that, is to just remind people. Marie Curie, and I think they got one of the Trump specials. The wonderful lady who did so much for cancer, Mary Berry. Is it Mary Berry? Marie Curie. That's what I said. I said Marie Curie. You're fired. Just to remind people, those charities are out there. Marie Curie's one. Tusk is another one. My daughter's running the charity marathon for them. Tusk, who does wildlife conservancy in Africa. These charities are out there and they're needing support.
Yeah, but also not to lose that fact about being together. I mean, you know, a lot of your Twitter followers, I mean, they're loving your contributions on social media at the moment. I mean, you know, you've got some absolute crackers. I mean, is that where this is going to go now for a bit in terms of keeping us together digitally, keeping the voice going digitally?
Well, I call them my Captain Corona tweets, which I think they're kind of a way of stopping me going mad. And I was in makeup the other day doing a thing. I happened to have the wig and I happened to, you know, have the photograph. So I just put out the most recent tweet. As I don't have a platform, as I don't have a show, it's just a way of kind of just saying what I think. And I try to, when things work most successfully, I think, in terms of sort of topical comedy, it's where, you know, you're hopefully, because you just enjoy comedy and you enjoy making people laugh. So that is the sort of prime impulse, but also that it has something to say behind it, that, you know, it's what you're thinking at that time. And that's what satire is, you know. It's about ridiculing sometimes. And, you know, that's, I go back to Bird and Fortune again, who had this amazing ability week in, week out to identify a policy or an individual. And George Parr, you know, would embody that character. And by the end of that 7 or 8 minutes of television, you go, how could they stand up?
It was wonderful. It was wonderful.
Yeah. And that was winning over. And that goes right back to a book that influenced me much more than any other. And that was Candide, which is by Voltaire in the late 18th century. And that was in a world where, you know, people were being encouraged to believe that God knew what he was doing and that everything was for the best, in the best of all possible worlds, as Voltaire put it. And after the Lisbon earthquake, where thousands died, Voltaire thought, this is just, how can people believe this? So he used every weapon in the satirist's army, armory, to write this novel, Candide, where his character Candide is taken around the world and sees plague and war and suffering, and his philosophy is tested to destruction at the end of that book. You think, what do you mean the best of all possible worlds? Of course it is. It's done with such humour, and all of the weapons, as I say, all the weapons of the satirist armoury are in that book.
And your philosophy, your view of the world, I mean, you've seen the world over some pivotal decades. How have you changed?
I come down to a shallow thing. Actually, I come back to the last line in that book, Candide, which is Il faut cultiver notre jardin. And that basically, I understand that to mean that you can't change the world, but you can just do your best to improve the part of it where you are, you have an influence, or where you live, you know, in either physically or culturally. Just, and that kind of boils down to an even more simple philosophy, which I try to just inculcate with my children. I just say, do your best and be kind.
It strikes me that your voice has never been more important. You know, there is that saying, isn't there, that a good laugh heals a lot of hurts. I mean, this is a world that's hurting at the moment.
A lot of hurt. Things happening, and look at America now. But we're doing tremendously. Look at our numbers, Michael. We've got tremendous numbers. We're over 100,000 now. Tremendous numbers. And yeah, I take your point absolutely. And you know, you have to look at Twitter, what would be my Twitter feed on a good day, to see, you know, there's division, and it's come about, you know, as I say, since these referenda and the binary nature, and the people, you know, I always used to love the French way of talking about discussions, discuter, where you could have a different opinion, and you'd have a ding dong, and you'd have a discussion about it, and you could do it in a good human and a good natured way. And I think, you know, increasingly it's become very difficult to do that, and people think unless you absolutely come round to their point of view, they will try every trick in the book to trip you up, to turn you over, to get you flat on your back. Because they disagree with you. And I think you can disagree with people, and you can put that case. And I'd rather put that case with humor than with violence or with anger.
But I've always felt humor is the greatest riposte. I mean, it's a way to shine a light on absurdity. So many things. Rory, we're regrettably out of time. I mean, I was reading here that you've never been told by Channel 4 that Bremner Bird and Fortune has actually stopped, and that you were like one of those Japanese soldiers who'd been told that the war isn't over. Well, I think for you, sir, the war definitely isn't over, because we're not ready for you to surrender. That's been Changemakers with the wonderful Rory Bremner. We'll see you next time.